Steve and Dave again. We are two guys in a river. I'm Steve Mathewson.
And I'm Dave Getz.
No doubt we all want to catch more fish. I want to, and Dave needs to.
Ooh, that hurts.
But we're all about fly fishing and our love for the outdoors, so let's get after it. If you're a fly fisher, you have a lot of people to thank. There's the friend or family member who introduced you to the sport and helped you through the awkward phase. Then there's the fly shop owner or fly shop staff who answer your questions and give you great advice and tell you what flies to use. Then there are the authors who teach you skills. And I think of how much I've learned from reading books by Bud Lilly and Gary Borger and others. Also, there are the folks at Trout Unlimited who do so much to help with the preservation of our fisheries. It really takes a village to raise a fly fisher. But there's another group of folks who are vital to the success of fly fishers, but we probably don't think of them as allies or friends, and yet they really are, right, Dave?
Absolutely. I've hunted for years in North Dakota and fished for years, and of course, fly fished since what? Well, we won't even say how many years. Just say multiple decades with you. And, this next group is really, really critical to the sport and all sports, outdoor sports.
And we're talking about conservations or game wardens, as they've been called in the past. They work the law enforcement side of our sport, and what they do is critical to protect it. And today we are honored to have a Wisconsin conservation warden on our podcast. He's here to check Dave's licenses, but we thought we'd get an interview out of him first. Seriously.
Whoa, hey, how about those Cubs? Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, you might have to buy a license this year, Dave.
No.
We're always up on that. But seriously, we'd like to welcome Michael Burns, a Wisconsin warden who's lived in the Driftless area around La Crosse, Wisconsin, most of his life. And Dave and I love fishing that area. Mike has been in law enforcement for 10 years and has served as a Wisconsin warden since 2018. Michael, welcome to our podcast, and thank you so much for your service in law enforcement. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'm glad I could meet with both of you, and I'm sure you got a lot of good questions, kind of turning the tables. Normally, I'm the one asking the questions. So,
yeah, that's right. Well, let's get right to it. Mike, what is it that you love about what you do? You know, what do you look forward to when you get up in the morning as it relates to your work as a game warden or a conservation warden?
It's refreshing and nice to know in my own personal life, I'm an avid fisherman, hunter, everything. So to dream up a job where you can regulate the activities in which you enjoy on a personal basis is absolutely fabulous. So it really is a calling. Fortunate to be able to hold this position and do the thing that I really love. So, seasonally, of course, everything changes in the warden service. You know, currently in the springtime here, it's turkeys, it's fish, it's a whole lot of things as the weather warms up. And the opportunity to just be outside and people that are like-minded like myself and really enjoy the resource that's out there.
Maybe we could ask you to tell us about one of your funniest experiences, and then maybe on the other side, one of your most tense experiences as a warden. So yeah, something funny, but then something more frightening or at least intense.
I guess we deal with a lot of intense encounters, oftentimes helping the sheriff's office. We are law enforcement in the state of Wisconsin. So naturally in rural law enforcement, I don't live anywhere near a large city or municipality. We're often called upon to, dangerous situations or public safety elements that really need your time and attention. So as a warden, of course, we encounter a lot of people with firearms, probably more so than your traditional law enforcement. However, most of the hunting clientele is exactly that. They're well-behaved. They know what they're doing. It's not you're dealing with dangerous people. So can't really cite a specific example that was the most tense. Just assisting with general police and sheriff's deputy calls for either domestic disturbance or, man with a gun. And if it has any kind of rural relevance to it, where the man's out in the woods or out on the water in a remote location, oftentimes we're called upon because we have the tools to get back in there and handle the situation. So armed subjects out in the woods, there's certainly been more than a few of those that have been tasked with trying to locate. Yeah, it makes for certainly a tense experience. However, on what I really enjoy about it is just talking with people. I mean, of course it's natural resource generated. But oftentimes if you're going to run into me, I'll probably just talk your ear off because I just like talking to people and being rather a conversationalist. Most people that we encounter on vacation are having a good time when they're out and about.
You know, specifically, let's say fly fishers or spinner fishers that are fishing some of the streams in the Driftless. What's kind of the most common mistake that they make, either in terms of their licenses or things that you have to kind of continually remind them about?
Yeah. So in particular, like fly fishermen, I'd like to kind of lump those folks in kind of the camp of the same as musky fishermen. They're really well behaved. And a lot of that is just because to get into the sport, it's very cost prohibitive oftentimes. Of course, you can do it on the cheap side, but like musky guys, trout guys aren't afraid to put a couple $100 on a fishing rod. And their fly box is probably several $100 worth. And so the $20 fishing license or $40 fishing license is usually not a large hurdle to jump. So by and large, trout anglers are incredibly well behaved. You know, they really care about the resource. The nice thing about trout as it relates to kind of the overall, trout only live in rather pristine waters where the land is taken care of. And generally you have really cold water. And so there's a conservation ethic within fly fishermen too, to maintain, the fishery in which they're fishing. So by and large, you know, to cast a wider net for trout anglers in general, they're very good. But if I was to identify common violations here in Wisconsin, several of our streams have different bag limits, possession limits that they can have. And it's important to in which order you go to some of these streams. So when I'm talking to people, there's some trophy streams where you may be only allowed to keep two fish of a large size. It's important to go to those streams first. Rather, and then go to, you know, if you're looking to keep trout, then go to a stream that has a 5 fish bag limit. Because if you were to do it vice versa and you're have three or four fish in the back of your truck and you're on a stream that can only have two, it becomes problematic. And that there's an important order in which you have to start. So when you're planning out your opening weekend fly trip in Wisconsin, look at those trophy waters where the possession or daily bag limit is lower. And start with those and then finish your day if you're interested in keeping fish on the streams in which you can keep more, like the 5 fish bag limit streams. So, you know, a common mistake that a lot of people make, certainly not intentional. Oftentimes you can tell whether people are intentionally doing it or where these fish likely came from, but try not to put people in sticky situations. But the nature of trout fishing is you're often walking streams and will fish multiple streams in a given day. So that's probably the most common one of the violations that I would see.
Yeah, that makes sense. We do so much catch and release that we probably don't think about that much. But yeah, that's really helpful. I have to say we do identify as the guys with wow, I hate to think how much money I have tied up in my fly box. I've tied a few of them, but even between materials and then what you buy, it adds up. So I'm curious, Mike, what are some of the funniest questions that you've been asked, if you think of any, you know, from anglers, or could be hunters as well?
I was in a fast food restaurant several years ago, and naturally in our profession, we have badges, patches, all kinds of things, trucks to tell, they'll say conservation warden on the side of it. And to speak to the relevance of the warden service, often if you're not engaged in some form of hunting, fishing, trapping, state park you're using, and you've lived your entire life in the urban environment, you maybe haven't had a touch point with a warden in your entire life. So while in one of these fast food joints, one of the cashiers was like, What is a warden? I, like a game warden, thinking that there was just some common mistake that their hiccup there was the conservation prelude to the warden. So we're like, you know, it's a game warden. And the person's reaction was, well, I didn't play many sports as a kid. trying to make the connection with game meaning sports, like a referee. You had to kind of put it in perspective, you know, like, a lot of people haven't heard what we are, especially, like I said, if you don't participate in any of our regular activities. But it was just kind of kind of funny and yet refreshing to talk with somebody that was relatively clueless as far as what we were out on the landscape.
Yeah, you're a conservation referee or a conservation umpire, I guess. That's pretty good. Yeah. Do you think of any questions that you wish fly fishers would ask, or other outdoors folks, whether they're hunting or what, whatever?
And so I have the great fortune of, I wouldn't say necessarily brokering people's good, kind of vacation time, because I'm not taking any cash or anything, but I like to, you know, direct people where they're going to have a good time. Ultimately, Wisconsin's blessed with abundant natural resources in every which direction that you look. And so when talking with particularly fly fishermen, I can appreciate somebody who calls ahead of time to, they want to have a good time while they're here, and I want to see them have a great time. So I'm happy to direct them to public access points or places where they're going to have a good time. And oftentimes that conversation starts with, what are your expectations when coming to Wisconsin? Are you looking for a 24-inch brown? Are you looking for, a nice brook trout stream where, the fish for linear miles is in the thousands? You know, I like telling people, or at least giving them a heads up as far as what they can expect and where to go. The regulation element to that, I hate to see people get in trouble. I prefer to talk to people ahead of time and avoid mistakes. And especially in the trout realm, as it relates to trespassing or access. We're blessed to have the public trust doctrine that we have in Wisconsin to be able to walk up navigable water bodies. And in addition to that, a lot of the trout stamp money and funding that we get through the DNR has bought easements. Whether it's 33 feet on either side of a particular stream, we're very eager on these trophy fisheries, or any trout fishery for that matter, to purchase perpetual easements with landowners. So where I'm going with this is there are certain stream miles that it's private property on both sides. Absolutely, you can be in the stream. Absolutely, you can go around an obstruction if there was a down log. Having those conversations where you don't have a landowner screaming at you, and you're very well versed and where you can't be, because the last thing I want folks that are coming to our state is having a bad experience, not only for them, but creating a headache for adjacent landowners.
I don't think I knew that, Mike, about the Dripless, and I have fished there for 30 some years. Steve and I started our fly fishing in Montana, and so they have the streamside access law, which is you can fish any water that goes through any property as long as you can access it through a bridge up to the high water mark. So what is the law in Wisconsin?
In short, very similar to Montana, probably scaled back a little bit. I know Montana, they did some really great work, I think 30 years ago, to firm up their law. Ours, kind of put simply, is keep your feet wet. So if you're in a navigable water body, keeping your feet wet means exactly that. Keep your feet in the stream. If you can go outside of the stream at the ordinary high water mark to go around a down log, but you must immediately return to the stream, ensuring your intentions of being there are lawful. So there is an opportunity to get out of the stream, but if you're casting on the bank without an easement, you're trespassing. The only way you can exit that water body is, a log or some form of an obstruction, maybe a dam, to get up and around and then right back into the water.
Otherwise, though, if you're on property that has an easement, like I think of, one of the areas that we fish, not that far from Dodgeville, and it's, I'm sure it's an easement. There's stiles there and signs about kind of with a reminder of the regulations. I'm assuming then it's okay that you stay, if you're along the bank, just not wandering 50 yards out into a farmer's field or into their pasture.
Yeah, absolutely. You're spot on. Oftentimes those easements are 33 feet on either side of the bank. As we know, especially in the summertime, these trout waters get to be a jungle, and it's difficult to even walk in the stream. We're fortunate to have a lot of these easements where you can cover a fair amount of country and hit the holes that you really want to hit without disrupting any kind of fish on your way to them. So we're very active in the Driftless area to purchase easements, very interested in landowners that are willing to work out a deal with us and purchase easements. And it's a very good starting point for trout anglers coming to the state. You can look on our website, a particular mapping app to identify these easements. But like you said, too, on a lot of bridge crossings and road crossings, there's clear signage telling you this is an easement and these are the regulations if it's a specific fishing regulation to that body of water.
I was talking to an author, I think he's out of Decorah, Iowa, but he was a partner in creating the Trout Routes app, or else he just created a book that syncs up both the book with the Trout Routes app. And he was saying, I was in a bookstore and ran into him, and he said something to the effect that some of these easements are like seven-figure deals between them and the state. They're very, I don't know if the word is lucrative, and I'm just really grateful for that. Is that true? And now this was in Northeast Iowa and Southeast Minnesota. Is that the same as true in Wisconsin?
We don't disclose any of the information or sale items when we purchase an easement. However, like you said, these easements that we purchase are in perpetuity. They're forever. We're not really purchasing trout easements or river access easements for shortened periods of time. All the easements that I can remember are in perpetuity. Regardless of who the landowner is from 1,000 years from now, there'll be trout fishermen using that easement. As far as the dollar price, we have people in our real estate department that can really kind of put a price to it. But like most state governments, we have to balance a budget every year, and there's only so much funding to go around. So we're very tactful in where that money goes to best afford the public an opportunity to increase access.
I actually was really surprised when I moved here from Colorado. Of course, Colorado has one of the worst water rights just because the landowner owns the land, what's underneath the river, right? So you can't trespass. It has no access at all up those rivers, even creeks if they run through somebody's property. So I was really surprised when I moved here to the Chicagoland area, started fishing the Driftless area, just the amount of easement. So I guess I'm just making a statement that compared to like Montana or even Colorado, or especially Colorado, Montana, you have the streamside access law. But I guess it's just a comment on the Driftless region in general, the generosity of landowners. I'm just very grateful for that.
Tremendously. We have some great private land stewards. As an agency, certainly we can't take any kind of credit for the work that NGOs and these private land stewards put into their property to see it to the next generation. So all the credit goes to these landowners that are really willing to accept public folks coming on their land and enjoying the resource as much as they do.
Once again, we're talking today with Wisconsin Warden Mike Burns. We really appreciate him joining us. Mike, one of the questions that I have kind of grows out of an experience I had last fall in Montana, but just tell us a little bit about what we have to be aware of when it comes to venomous snakes. I almost stepped on a rattler last year in Montana, and it was a place where I knew they could be, but it still surprised me. And I'm aware that there's some, I'm assuming there's some rattlesnakes around, maybe not huge populations. And I don't know if there's anything else, any cottonmouths or any, oh my goodness, back in my grandparents' farm in Pennsylvania, I used to run into a lot of copperheads. So anything like that that we need to be careful of and be aware of.
Yeah, so the Driftless area is home to, as far as reptile-wise, we do have some eastern rattlesnakes. They like to den up in hibernacula, which is basically their winter den in a lot of the bluff country in and around here. We do have some massasaugas, which would be the rattlesnake, I guess the water rattlesnake cousin of the eastern rattlesnake, where they frequent the streams. However, that's really a threatened, it may even be an endangered species. It doesn't occur with a lot of frequency, the Massasauga that is. But by and large, as far as venomous reptiles, that's probably about it. We're pretty fortunate to operate with little regard walking through some tall grass, knowing that there's very few things that are going to jump up and get you.
Just to pivot from that conversation about risk, I had an experience on a stream, actually not too far from Dodgeville, a couple winters ago, in which I just got in the mud and I sank down into my probably up to my hips, and it was 30 degrees, and my friend was about a half mile upstream and wasn't coming anytime soon. I had my cell phone. There was not water coming in over my waders. I just couldn't get out. And I thought, holy cow. And I kind of, it took me about 15, 20 minutes to slowly work my legs out. And then I kind of threw myself forward. I was close enough to the stream, or to the edge of the stream, excuse me. So, you know, it caught me really by surprise. I've been in the outdoors my entire life. I've been swept down river in the Yellowstone once, but this actually kind of threw me, and I wasn't being careless. What are some of the other types of things that we should be aware of?
There's all kinds of, hopefully you find a bottom when you jump into some of these siltier mud holes. You know, you don't have to deal with it so much so in a lot of trout water, just because it has a really firm bottom. But whether it's trout anglers, duck hunters, or trappers, all kind of experience a endless silt hole, if you will. That's rather harrowing to get out at times.
What does it take to become a Wisconsin warden? And I assume it would be similar to other states, just in terms of education, experience, maybe temperament. What kind of background or preparation makes for a good warden?
And in fact, right now through May 7th is when we're have our application period for our next warden class that would start in January of 2025. So the timing is absolutely perfect. So when looking to become a conservation warden, at least here in Wisconsin, all we require at the ground level to apply is you have to have a high school diploma. So for most people, that's a check. You got to be 21 years of age, have no felonies and no domestic violence convictions, and be able to possess a Wisconsin driver's license upon being a resident here. With that being said, you can be a resident of whatever state you want and happily come here to work. We'll be happy to have you. There's no requirement that you have to be a resident to be a warden, because we hire folks from all across the country every year, all different kinds of ages and job experience. So, we do require that you have to have 60 college credits within 5 years of hire. You know, most people take care of that on upfront with an associate's degree or bachelor's degree. However, not a requirement. You could take night classes upon being hired to accumulate 60 college credits within 5 years. But the experience component of that, you also do not have to be a credentialed law enforcement officer. So if you've worked an entire profession in marketing, business, construction, a parallel conservation group, non-government, or some other form of government, we'll happy to have you. There's no requirement that you have to be a police officer for any amount of time, because we'll, quite frankly, put you through our own training and train you the way we want to train you. So that's certainly not a barrier to entry for those who have a vast array of life experience. And they can draw from that experience into this career, whether it's dealing with high pressure situations. There's all kinds of jobs that aren't exclusive to wardens that have high deals of stress, or just a roller coaster of emotion talking with people. We realize that there's all kinds of attributes that people have and different life experiences that they can bring to the warden service. And once their feet hit the ground, they're absolutely incredible at the job. Some of my greatest friends and coworkers have come from really diverse backgrounds, whether that was marketing, business. Some of them had careers where they're coming to the warden service at 45 years old. Absolutely. These people are extremely capable, love the career. And it's really something aspirational where if you apply 1 year and they tell you no, continue to apply. Like for me personally, it took me 3 times to apply to this hiring class before I was hired. I wouldn't say that's unusual. Some people do get it on their first try. Other times it may take folks like myself 2 or 3 tries to get familiar with the process to where you come for that third interview, that third year, you're polished, prepared, can knock it out of the park. So the career appeals to a lot of people, regardless of where you are in your life. If you're looking for something that's rewarding, where you have self-satisfaction, you really are ingrained within the community, the warden service is a fabulous landing spot.
Mike, are there any myths about wardens that you would want to dispel? I guess people have different stereotypes or just these ideas that, who knows, maybe they get from television or whatever. And anything like that, that you'd say, yeah, this is not how it works.
and I've been trying to dispel these for years. The number one thing is wardens never have time to hunt or fish. I mean, that is, it is ubiquitous. As you say the word conservation warden or game warden, you're going to hear a comment just like that. You know to expect it, right? And so that honestly is really not the case. Speaking personally, I get more than enough opportunities to fill my personal goals to get out and about, whether that's fishing or hunting, in and around my work calendar. So the nice thing about being a warden is we operate to be able to control our own schedule in many respects, because the last thing you want is a warden that you can set your your watch to that's at the coffee shop at 8 o'clock every day on a Tuesday morning. That's not good business. There is an element to being unpredictable, differing your work schedule to, kind of approach a station to be able to answer to all user groups that use the station. So varying up my schedule is something that I do quite frequently. And on that same note, it allows me the opportunity to set personal goals for myself, whether that's hunting or fishing. Speaking personally, just today I was out turkey hunting this morning and then started work at 9 o'clock. So certainly scratches the itch if you're coming into the profession with the thought of, I'm never going to be able to hunt or fish ever again. Far from the truth. In fact, I would argue it's the opposite. You're just going to have even more knowledge where the fish are hanging out, where the ducks, the geese, the deer like to frequent. You'll be a lot more efficient with your time out in the field.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I don't know if it's a trade secret or anything, if it's even appropriate to ask, but it seems to me like that could allow you to do undercover kind of work. I mean, I'm assuming that when you're out hunting or fishing that it's like an off-duty police officer. You could make an arrest. Hopefully you don't have to do that, but you could cite somebody, right? If you see a violation.
Yeah, we are afforded the ability to sometimes hunt or fish while in work status. However, it's very rare. You need a specific instance as to why you otherwise couldn't contact a certain hunter or angler wearing the entire accoutrement of duty gear. Oftentimes that takes the place of dams, where once the warden rolls over the hill, people run for the hills. Yeah. Where if you are fishing in plain clothes next to people, it affords you an opportunity to not only surveil the area a little bit better, but gather evidence of crimes so much easier. So there is small opportunities for that. Speaking personally, that may only be one or two times a year where I may do that. More often than not, it's the same thing, sitting on a hill with binocular or spotting scope to surveil people. But the second part of your question there about So we have the ability to order ourselves to work because my boss doesn't tell me when I start every day. If I want to order myself to work status, as long as I have the appropriate duty gear, if I'm out and about, I can order myself to work status and immediately react to a certain situation that I may encounter. So unlike traditional law enforcement that works shifts or has oversight prohibiting that, we're still afforded the flexibility to order ourselves to work, assuming we have the appropriate duty gear, means of communication, and it's cleared with your supervisor ahead of time. And in some instances in state law, we're bound to act in situations of life-threatening danger as off-duty police officers. There's certainly an expectation there above and beyond what the public would be expected to do. We'd be asked to intervene.
So you were a warden before COVID. Did you see a significant increase in, let's just say, fly fishers after COVID? And has that abated? Has that continued? Seeing more, less fly fishers? What are you seeing out there in the Driftless where you serve?
Yeah, I would say it's probably holding steady. Of the fly fishermen, I would say the demographic's changing. The folks that want to go out and buy a dozen worms, fish from a bridge, take a few trout home, I think that's probably on the decline. Real similar to like bass fishing. It's gotten so popular that the fish holds so much more value alive than it does in people's dinner plates. And again, that's up to the particular angler, whether they want to make that decision or not. But I would say there's often socially, maybe some pressures or just changing demographics why people aren't choosing to keep a trout, where 50 years ago, that was a tremendous resource, where opening day, people would be out and about wanting to get to their limited trout a few family, put it in the freezer and enjoy trout. So as far as overall numbers, I would say they're probably remaining the same, at least in my area, but they look a little different. And, you know, speaking to the investment that, you know, both you two put in fly fishing gear and equipment, folks probably look real similar to you guys do when you're out enjoying the trout.
Maybe to follow up on that, Mike, what trends have you noticed about fly fishing in the driftless, you know, whether that's related to the fish or angler activity? And I guess those could be encouraging or either concerning trends, but just curious, just as you kind of look at, you know, fly fishing, fly fishers, the fish in general, anything you see that, you know, kind of emerging as a trend, or maybe something that you know, we ought to watch for as we think about our sport?
And the encouraging part of it is people are very much connected to the land, where before it really was, you know, resource first. I think there's more attention put to landscapes, you know, whether that's cover crops in and around these trout streams, adjacent landowners, real stewards of the land, like I spoke to earlier, that are looking to do what's right for their land in perpetuity. So, I mean, that's a really encouraging thing, starting from the landowners, but it also kind of translates well to fly fishermen too. With the increase in land prices, I think that in trout streams in particular, because they hold the habitat to support trout, that just means you have stable soil, you know, cold water, good forestry practices that come along with trout, where that land is extremely valuable. And the people are really interested in seeing it into the future. And moreover, I was talking with our fisheries biologist just the other day, and they're classifying a lot more miles of trout stream in and around my particular area than they ever have, meaning there's the habitat to support it, the cold water. They're seeing trout where previously they hadn't seen trout. Oftentimes this has to do with flow temperature. And it's really encouraging to see that we classify more water as trout water because it speaks to the larger landscape health. Meanwhile, kind of outside of the driftless area, I spoke with a separate fisheries biologist that is declassifying several miles of trout stream because trout are no longer present there. Rather concerning. And if you were to look on either side of the stream in that particular case, it doesn't come as a surprise that some of the agricultural practices going in and around upstream on that particular tributary aren't the best. It's plagued with runoff, high dissolved nutrients that take oxygen out of the water. Ultimately there just isn't any trout being found there. But in large, I would say the driftless area may be increasing as the sustainable trout water that we have out there as a whole, which is really encouraging.
So I grew up in North Dakota, and for many, many years, up until probably 10 years ago, we had a great pheasant hunting. And usually South Dakota is considered the state for pheasant hunting, but North Dakota also has just a lot of grouse, Hungarian partridge. But we also had a lot of pheasants, and there was two things that kind of put that in decline. One was the lack of CRP. They weren't putting more acreage into the crop reduction program, which takes tillable land and puts it into the natural grass, and then in which the government pays the farmers or the ranchers to do that. And then also GPS farming, where they now farm right up to the fence line. And so have you seen the GPS farming where there's farming really, I guess, probably up to that 33 feet from the stream? But when you're that close, there is a lot of silt and a lot of even fertilizer and stuff that gets thrown into the stream. Are you seeing that? Or do you feel like that most farmers are really sensitive to that, at least in the driftless region?
Speaking broad, and I certainly don't speak for farmers, but I just in my observations, the driftless area is rather progressive in farming techniques, whether that's no-till, just drill into the soil where you're not aerating or kicking your topsoil up into the air to get blown away somewhere else, creating these grassy waterways. There's federal programs through NRCS to keep cover crops on grassy waterways, maintaining a buffer in and around streams, whether you're enrolled in one of our easements or not, that by and large landowners are doing the best they can, knowing that long-term success, they'd rather have their soil in the field rather than in the water. So naturally it's in their best interest to do what's best for the land. And that's resonated really well. Just speaking in the Driftless area and in particular around here where there's still that small farm where they own, 50 dairy cows, 120 acres, where in the rest of the country, that's really kind of down and out. Fortunately to have a stronghold community here in the Driftless area where small farms, small acreage is still relatively common.
We've been visiting today with Wisconsin Warden Mike Burns. Mike, maybe one final question for me, and Dave might have a follow-up, but is there anything else that you wish the public knew about your role as a warden? Anything that might be helpful that maybe gets overlooked?
And what it boils down to is we are a community resource. There's not a whole lot of us. There may only be one or two wardens in a particular county. That's pretty common. But we really are centered on public safety and resource protection. So prioritizing the public, we've tried to increase our relevance, appealing to a larger crowd. In the last decade, we've been the sole law enforcement entity in our state parks, which has broadened our demographic of people that we interact with. And just trying to increase the relevance of the warden service, because we all use natural resources. Here in Wisconsin, we're incredibly blessed with the abundance of natural resources. Whether you pay for a fishing license or you pay for a hunting license, you're taking some benefit from the natural resources. The relevance to the warden services, there's very few of us, but we create a relevance and an importance of the natural resources where we are available to the public. If they have any questions, they can always contact us. We're public employees. We live in the communities that we work. We're not police outfit where we live in some community and we work in a different one. I'm not interested in irritating any members of my community. I'm here. It's much better if I'm friendly, be a community resource. People come to me for their particular, triumphs or challenges. What I just kind of hope that people knew about the warden services, we're not looking to just catch you when you're doing something wrong. I love it when I talk to people on vacation when they're having a good time. I hope that I don't have to ruin that great time that somebody's having. And more often than not, when I'm here to talk with you, you've probably done absolutely nothing wrong. And that's the greatest thing. When you see a warden, it's not that you've done anything wrong. We're afforded the opportunity to talk with people before anything wrong ever happens, where traditional law enforcement is still dispatched, telling them to go to this call, go to this call, constantly putting out fires, where we really are the model of community policing, where we are in the community, and I'd love to talk with you when you've done absolutely nothing wrong. So if you talk to me and you get the sense that I'm fishing for something, illegal going on, more than likely I'm shooting the breeze with you and just enjoying conversation.
I do have one final question, and that is, do you watch the Joe Pickett series on Hulu?
I haven't. I've heard about it. Sounds like a really interesting author then turned TV series. And I think is it Idaho Conservation Warden is the thought
Wyoming.
There?
Yeah, Wyoming.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. There's a lot of warden programs on television now where previously it was all, cops or some variant of that, where a lot of states are kind of highlighting the warden service. And it resonates well with our recruiting program. A lot more people apply because they were interested. They saw it on TV, which bodes well for us. It is really neat to kind of shine a spotlight on some of these wardens in other states and certainly really interesting work.
Yeah, that Joe Pickett series seems like what you would experience in a lifetime of being a warden happens in one episode, and then they're on to the next. So, well, hey, we want to thank Wisconsin Warden Mike Burns for joining us today on our podcast. Mike, thanks for what you do and the insights you shared. And I'm honest when I say I hope Dave and I run into you sometime. It'd be fun to talk, because I know we fish in that same area, the Driftless, where you serve. So thanks again for being with us today.
Great talking with you too. And again, if you if anybody out there wants to know a little bit more in and around my area, you could just go to the Wisconsin DNR website, look up conservation warden in whatever particular county you're interested in. Give us a phone call if you want to reach out to our fisheries biologist if you're planning a trip to the Driftless area or any other part of Wisconsin. We are public employees. We're happy to provide people that are traveling to the area and or residents of the state a little quality of life and opportunity to go catch the fish or turkey or deer of their dreams.
Well, it takes a village to raise and help fly fishers, and that village includes some important people called wardens. The law enforcement side of fly fishing, our sport is better off because of their role, and so we salute them, including you as well, Mike. All right, that's all for today. Thanks again for listening. I'm Steve Mathewson.
And I'm Dave Getz.
Until next time, we are two guys in a river.
For the love of fly fishing.